In September, the year paused, weary from the harvest, and inhaled deeply for the fall planting, wine press, and slaughter. The air grew cool, and the broadleaf trees shivered in anticipation. Time enough in this interstice between the summer and autumn labors to finish the repairs from the great fire, and to wed Seppel to Ulrike. The nuptials took place on the village green, where the witnesses could gather round the couple. There, Seppel declared his intent, and Ulrike, dressed in traditional bridal yellow, declared her consent, after which everyone proceeded up Church Hill. The Lateran Council had required that all weddings be public, but not that the church participate in them. Nonetheless, despite his losses in the fire, Felix had elected a nuptial mass for his daughter's marriage. Dietrich preached a sermon on the history and development of marriage and explained how it was a figure of Christ wed to his church. He was well into the contrast between Munte, or family alliance, and Freide, the love match favored by the church. When he sensed the restlessness of the congregants and the growing concupiscence of the wedding couple, and drew his discourse to a hasty and ill-reasoned conclusion. Friends and relatives paraded the couple from the church to a cottage that Volkmar had prepared for them, and watched them lie together in the bed, giving helpful last-minute advice all the while. Then the neighbors withdrew and waited outside the window. Dietrich, who had stayed behind at the church, heard the shout and the pot banging all the way at the top of the hill. He turned to Joachim, who was helping him strip the altar. "It's a wonder young people wed publicly at all, if this is what they must endure." "Yes," said Joachim with a hooded look. "A wood's marriage has its advantages." By its tone, the Minorite's remark was freighted with irony, and Dietrich wondered what he had meant by it. The singular advantage of privately spoken vows lay in their easy denial afterwards. Absent witnesses, who could say what was promised or whether consent was given? A marriage, promised in the throes of passion, could fade with that selfsame passion. To combat this evil, the church insisted on public weddings. Even so, many couples still exchanged vows in the woods, or even in the bed itself. Dietrich folded the altar cloth in half, then in half again. He decided that Joachim had intended a humorous affirmation of Dietrich's own remark, and said, "Ugh," which earned a sharp glance, quickly suppressed, from the Franciscan. The rebuilt cottages were blessed on the commemoration of Pope Cornelius, still remembered as a friend to the poor, and therefore an auspicious patron for such a blessing. Luther Holzacker led a troop of men into the lesser wood below Church Hill, and there toppled a fir, perhaps 20 shoes tall, which they carried to the green with much ceremony. The men barked the trunk halfway to the top, leaving the uppermost branches untouched, and liberating the sweet piney scent of virgin wood. The remaining branches they decked with wreaths, garlands, and other ornaments, and a profusion of colored flags, and stood the tree in a post-hole prepared at the corner of Felix Ackermann's cottage. Afterward there was singing and dancing, and tankards of beer, and the flesh of a roast pig that Ackermann and the brothers Feldman offered jointly as a love gift to their neighbors. The festivities spread from the cottages down the length of the high street, spilling around the well, the oven, and into the meadow by the millpond. The armsmen who had helped fight the fires came down from the burg to join the celebration. They were a swaggering lot, older than their years and possessed of a hardness beside which the village youth seemed callow. More than one maiden found herself beguiled by tales of far lands and fell deeds, and more than one soldier found himself beguiled by fair maid. Fathers glowered with suspicion, and mothers with disapproval. Such men seldom possessed land and were poor matches for a peasant's daughter. After solemnly blessing tree and cottages, Dietrich stood apart and observed the festivities. He was solitary by nature. One reason he had come to this remote village. Buridan had often chastised him for this love. "You live inside your head too much," the master had said. "And while it is sometimes a very interesting head, it must also be a little lonely in there." The jape had much amused the visitor from Oxford, who, on encountering Dietrich mulling over his copybook in solitary places about the university, had taken to calling him Dr. Seclusus. Occam owned the most brilliant mind Dietrich had ever encountered, but his affections often had an edge to them. A man clever with words, he had shortly after found the world composed of more than words, for he had been summoned to Avignon to answer questions.
"They think you unfriendly," said Lawrence, jostling him loose of memories. "You stand here by the tree when everyone else is over there."
He waved toward the sounds of fiddle and whistle and bagpipe, a congeries of noises with the seeming of familiar songs, yet attenuated a little by distance and the breeze, so that only snatches of tune remained sensible.
"I'm guarding the tree," Dietrich said with utter gravity.
"Are you?"
Lawrence turned his head up toward the bright decorations fluttering in the treetop. The breeze whipped the flags and garlands so that the tree, too, seemed to dance.
"And who might steal such a thing?"
"Grimm? Maybe? Or Eck?"
Lawrence laughed.
"What a fancy!"
The smith sank to his haunches and leaned back against the wall of Ackerman's cottage. He was not a large man. Gregor dwarfed him. But he was tempered like the very metal he worked, impervious to the strongest blows, and as supple as the famed steel of Damascus. His hair was black like an Italian's, and his skin had been tinted by the smoke of his forges. Dietrich sometimes called him Vulcan, for all the obvious reasons, though his features were exceedingly fine, and his voice higher pitched than one might expect from a man with such a soubriquet. His wife was a handsome woman, larger and older than he, of strong features and chaste demeanor. God had not blessed their union with fruit.
"I always loved those stories when I was young," the smith confessed. "Dietrich of Bern and his knights, fighting Grimm and all the other giants, outwitting the dwarves, rescuing the Ice Queen. When I see Dietrich in my mind, he always looks like you."
"Like me?"
"Sometimes I imagine new adventures for Dietrich and his knights. I thought I would write them myself had I my letters. There was one, I said it during the time the hero spent with King Etzel, that I thought especially fine."
"Well, you could always recite your tales for the children. You don't need your letters for that.
Did you know Etzel's real name was Attila?"
"Was it?
But no, I would never dare recite my stories. They wouldn't be true, only fancies I had made up."
"Lawrence, all of the Dietrich tales are fancies. Lawrence, Helm of Invisibility, Wittich's Enchanted Sword, the Mermaid's Bracelet that Wildebeer wore, dragons and giants and dwarves. When have you ever seen such things?"
"Well, I've always supposed that in this base age we have forgotten how to make enchanted swords. And as for the dragons and giants, why, Dietrich and the other heroes killed them all."
"Killed them all?" Dietrich laughed. "Yes, that would save the appearances."
"You said Etzel was real. What of the Goth kings, Theodoric and Ermanric?"
"Yes, they all lived in the Frankish age."
"Since so long?"
"Yes, it was Etzel who killed Ermanric."
"There, you see?"
"See what?"
"If they were real, Etzel and Hermann and Theodore, then why not Lorin the dwarf or Grimm the giant? Don't laugh. I met a pack peddler from Vienna once, and he told me that when they were erecting the cathedral there, the builders found huge bones buried in the earth. So, the giants were real, and their bones were made of stone. They named the portal the Giant's Gate because of it."
"They couldn't have done that if they had been only fancies."
The priest scratched his head.
"Albrecht the Great described such bones. He thought, with Avicenna, that they had been turned to stone by some mineral process. But they may be the bones of some great animal lost in the flood, and not of giant men."
"Perhaps the bones of a dragon, then,"
Lawrence suggested slyly, leaning close and placing a conspiratorial hand on his arm. Dietrich smiled.
"Do you think so?"
"Your tankard is empty. I'll fetch another."
Lawrence pushed to his feet and hesitated, half turned away.
"There is talk," he said after a pause.
Dietrich nodded. "There generally is. What of?"
"That you go too often into the woods with the Frau Müller."
Dietrich blinked and looked into his empty stein. He wondered why he should be surprised to learn of the gossip.
"Bluntly put, my friend, but the Herr has established a lazaretto.
In the great wood, ja, doch. But with the Frau Müller, we know also which way the rabbit runs, and if she truly is caring for lepers, that would be a second pair of boots.